رحم اللہ من قرأ الفاتحة. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، خاتم النبيين، شفيع المذنبين، رحمة للعالمين، مولانا وسيدنا أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرض، أرواحنا له الفداء، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين، من الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال أمير المؤمنين علي بن أبي طالب عجبت للبخيل يستعجل الفقر الذي منه هرب ويفوته الغنى الذي إياه طلب فيعيش في الدنيا عيش الفقراء ويحاسب في الآخرة حساب الأغنياء. صلوات على محمد وآل محمد. Respected scholars, Sheikh Muiz, respected elders, brothers, sisters, Salaamu Alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's very nice to be here once again amongst you brothers, elders, community members. It's been around 3 years we have not met. Inshallah, Allah keeps our bonds strong under the banner of Ahlul Bayt. This year, our topic is going to be as follows: how to connect the soul properly to this world and the hereafter. Let me just expand upon this for a few minutes and then we'll move on to the exact topic for today. Why the soul? Why do we always talk about the soul? Well, very frankly and honestly, our main identity is the soul. Whether we spend time on this earth looking after our bodies, looking after our health, looking after the way we look, where we live, how we live, what we eat, where we go for holiday, what we do in our spare time, etc., etc., that doesn't matter. Once death occurs, you will find that the only thing which transfers to the next world is the soul. So the soul of a human being is his true reality. But we are in a tricky situation, because whilst we are a soul, the soul in this world needs a body in which it can operate. Once the soul comes out of the body, it's no longer in this world, is it? It's in the next world. The body is left behind, the body is buried, the soul goes forward. But whilst it's operating in this world, it needs a body. For example, let me just give you a quick example. I can see lots of young faces. Maybe they'll enjoy this example. It'll make sense to them. If you take a human being onto a different planet, take a human being onto the moon, he can't just go like this. He needs a spacesuit, because this body cannot survive on the moon because of various pressure conditions. So he needs a spacesuit. The same thing applies to the soul in this world. It cannot survive here without the body. Hence, when it needs to operate in this world, it needs a body like a spacesuit for it to operate. The confusion comes in because we spend so long and so much effort we put into taking care of the body, the body's pleasures, the body's needs, the body's activities, we forget about the soul. So we are caught in a conundrum. We understand the soul is our main identity and it's the only thing which is going to give us our next life, but we are caught in catch 22, because here we need the body to function. So we need to bear in mind how we can connect our souls to this world and the life hereafter. This is going to be our discussion in these few nights whilst we are remembering our beloved, our Mawla, our Master Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wa salam. Now, why do we not already connect with the hereafter? This is an issue which I want to spend a few minutes on. We hear every year, every week, every day sometimes, we hear majalis, we hear lectures. Generally speaking, the speakers tend to speak about things like taqwa, hereafter, spirituality. It doesn't have much effect on us. We have to ask why. So I'm going to put before you two scenarios, and you can judge for yourself which one you think applies to you. Number one, the first scenario is that, okay, I genuinely don't know what to do. I want to become a better person. I want to become a better Muslim. I want to become a better Shia of Ahlul Bayt. But I don't know what to do. Honestly speaking, you tell me, brothers and sisters, but I can see brothers in front of me, so it's easier for me to see your reaction. Honestly speaking, you put your hand on the heart and you tell me, in this day and age, is it a valid excuse that we don't know what to do? Is it a valid excuse that we suffer from lack of knowledge? I reckon anyone who says, I suffer from lack of knowledge of Islam, is going to have a tough time justifying that to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the hereafter. Allah is not going to buy that. We don't live in some jungle somewhere where we have no access to any knowledge. We have access at our fingertips like never before to knowledge, spirituality, information. We have all of it at the touch of our fingers. It's a wonderful hadith. Honestly, when I heard this hadith, it made me think that how amazing our imams were, that they told us things that just now it's making sense. They said it 1400 years ago, but today we can make sense of it. Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam. In one of his advices regarding the end of time, we have lots of hadith regarding Akhirul Zaman, end of time. Imam said something amazing. At that time, I guess people didn't know what he was saying. But today we can understand. What did he say? He said, a time will come near the end of time where a person will not know what to do. To give him the knowledge of what to do, he will just look at his palm. At that time, I don't know what they would have thought. I don't know what they would have concluded from this. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. But today we can understand. Gadgets, smartphones, 24 hours connected to the World Wide Web. We can understand easily. When we don't know something, it's a 10-second job. Look at your phone, type in a few characters, press return, and there you go. You have your answer. Ayatollah Google Zindabad. This is what it is. It's all there. It's at the touch of a thing. And Islam is no different. Honestly, Islam is no different. Islam today is more accessible than ever. I wonder what our famous scholars, Sheikh Kulaini, Sheikh Saduq, Sheikh Tusi, who God bless them and may he raise their station in the hereafter, would have to go to four corners of this world just to hear one hadith and write it down. And today we have those hadith, all of them available at our fingertips, and we hardly know any. What would they think, honestly? So it's going to be very difficult for us to justify. We say to God, oh Allah, actually I didn't know. He'll say, no way, you had the opportunity to know. So this is one excuse. The second excuse is, actually we know what to do, but we don't have the motivation for it. We don't have the motivation for it. We know what to do. We know what is right. We know what is wrong. Can't be bothered. Don't have enough time. Doesn't make sense. Doesn't appeal to me. What will my friend say? What will my classmates say? What will the people around me say? People will judge me. Now that's a different issue. So the first one, I don't think we can accept that someone says, I don't know what to do. No. The second one is the big issue. That is a reality. I know what to do, but I can't be bothered to do it. This is a motivational issue. Now, one thing, and I believe this is one of the whispers of shaitan. Brothers, can I speak very frankly? I'm going to speak very frankly because I regard you as my own family. So I'm going to speak like we would in a family, very frankly and honestly. One of the things which I think shaitan puts in our head sometimes is that he doesn't want us to take responsibility. You know, a human being, when you challenge a human being, when you criticize a human being, when you tell a human being, this is wrong, what's the first thing they do in general? They give you excuses. They say, no but, no but, no but. Oh, you don't understand, but this, but that. We always give excuses. So one thing which we have learned as a community to do very nicely, and mashallah we are experts in this, is when anything is wrong in the community, what do we say? The Maulanas don't speak about this on the minbar. They need to do more. I'm really sorry, I'm going to be as frank as possible with you. That is not acceptable for anyone to say that. The Maulana, nor me, nor Sheikh, nor anyone, is responsible for your actions on the Day of Judgment. The best we can do, the best we can do, is maybe plant an idea, spark some motivation, push you into a certain direction, but at the end of the day, the action you take and the path you choose is up to you. So what we are going to do in these lectures, inshallah, if Allah gives us tawfiq, we are going to concentrate on motivation. But don't think that the ingredient to solving all of our problems is going to come from only this one pulpit or from a Maulana. No, there has to be a time when you and me, we say, hang on a second, we have to take some responsibility here. We actually have to get up off our behind and we have to do something. Otherwise it's not going to happen. Don't rely on anyone to inspire you. You will have to inspire yourselves. We'll try. We will try. We try to inspire our kids, our elders, our youngers, whatever. We try to inspire, but who knows if it's going to work or not. The Holy Prophet tried to inspire people. Some people didn't get inspired from him. So what? Can they blame him? So this is our conundrum. So we will try to be as motivational and as supportive as possible, but believe me, the final decision, your free will is in your hands. Let us take a pledge now, first night of Muharram, on the name of our beloved third Imam, on the name of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Allah. That whatever happens in these 10 nights, we are going to take more responsibility for ourselves. No more excuses. No more excuses. We are going to take responsibility for ourselves. I much prefer, okay, now this is going to sound a bit weird because I'm going to talk about when someone does a sin. No sin is good. Sinning is bad. But I much prefer when someone, if he does a sin or she does a sin and they say, look, I know this is wrong. I know what I've done is wrong. Rather than someone who sins and says, you know what, I'm not sure here if this is right or wrong. Now that's an excuse. The first person has much more potential of change than the second. The first person has acknowledged that there is a problem. The second has not acknowledged that there is a problem. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, for tonight's main topic, we're going to start with something very gentle, very sensible. We're going to start with how our first Imam, the wonderful, wise, amazingly eloquent, brilliantly intelligent man that he was, how does he look at this world and what things surprise him? So he has this hadith in Nahjul Balagha. And he uses this word 6 times. Ajibtu. Ajibtu means, I find it very strange. I find it very ajeeb. And then he lists six things. Ajibtu. So ajibtu is used when things don't make sense. When you're expecting an outcome but something else happens. He uses it six times with six different things about our life in this world. So he begins and he says, ajibtu lil bakhil. The first thing he says is, I don't understand the miserly person, the stingy person. Ajibtu lil bakhil. Why? Well, why does someone become stingy? Why are some people afflicted with miserliness? See, it has a deeper reason. A miser is a miser because what he thinks is, if I spend too much, then I will be left without. If I give from my pocket too much, what will happen to me? I might need it. He says, Ajibtu lil bakhil. Why? Because he is speeding towards the very destitution which he fears. He fears poverty. So he's a miser. Imam says, no, he hasn't understood. He's actually living the life of a poor person. Because he's not spending where money should be spent. He's speeding towards the very destitution from which he wants to run away. Consequently, so what happens to this person? Very interesting. He passes his life in the world as a faqir. He lives in the world as a poor person. So then what about the hereafter? Will Allah say, you are a poor person? Poor people generally, they have less to account for. Because they were deprived in this world, so therefore in the life hereafter they don't have to account for that side of things. Imam says no. They live in the world like a poor, they have to give account in the hereafter like a rich. He said it absolutely doesn't make sense. So this is the first thing we want to discuss. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. What is the definition of bakhil? In Islam, we have a specific definition. A bakhil is someone who does not spend where it should be spent. This is definition of a bakhil. Where things should be spent, he doesn't spend. Does it relate to money alone? No. Bakhil can be in many different fields. Some people, I hate to say it, may Allah not count us as amongst these people. They're bakhil with knowledge. They know things they won't share. Why should I share the thing I know because it's going to benefit another person? I won't share. So they're bakhil with knowledge. Some people are bakhil with opportunity. My brother is unemployed. He could get a job. I've heard of a good opportunity in some places. I won't tell him. Why should I tell him? I'll keep it to myself. Bakhil with opportunity. Some people are bakhil with time. I am so consumed with my worldly life. I'm working all hours of the day. I'm working like a crazy person. My community needs me. Mosque needs me. Social body needs me. I won't give time. Why should I? I'm looking after number one. These are all instances of bakhil. When someone lives his life in this world, where he should be spending his time and his resources, he doesn't spend. Now take the example of the third Imam. He's the complete opposite. Someone may be generous with money, someone may be generous with time, someone may be generous with skills, knowledge. I challenge you, Imam Hussein was generous in everything. Time, love, knowledge, life. Imam gave the ultimate sacrifice, his life. No, not his life. The lives of his children. Have you ever seen a more generous person who's giving the life, not of himself, even of his children? It takes a special kind of person to do that. Now, let me tell you one story from the life of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Quran has this passage, Surah Al-Layl. If you want to have a look at it later, Surah Al-Layl, Surah number 92 of the Holy Quran, Allah says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allah gives an example. فَأَمَّا مَنْ أَعْطَى وَاتَّقَى. As for he who gives and is God-wary and confirms the promise of the hereafter, وَصَدَّقَ بِالْحُسْنَى, we will take him from difficulty and put him into ease. One who spends and has taqwa and believes in the hereafter, we will take him from difficulty and put him into ease. But as for he, وَأَمَّا مَنْ بَخِلَ وَاسْتَغْنَى, as for the one who is stingy and feels he is self-sufficient and denies the life hereafter, we will take him from ease and put him into hardship. Don't ever think that by conserving, keeping with you, it's going to be easier for you. No. You have a much difficult life ahead. Allah gives a promise here. That don't think by being stingy you are actually saving things for yourself. You are actually bringing upon yourself difficulty. We will surely put him into hardship. His wealth will avail him not when he dies. Honestly, it's very foolish. Now let me tell you the story from the life of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. This is something, honestly, I feel if our community leaders, no offense to anyone, I'm not talking about this place, I'm talking about every place in the world. If our community leaders understood the methodology of Rasulullah in solving people's problems, we would be somewhere else today. The small petty issues which we have between us would be a thing of the past. Just let me tell you the story and look at his methodology. So there was a house in Medina. In that house there was a garden. In the garden there was a date tree. This date tree had grown. It had grown so much that the branches of the tree started to hang over into the neighbor's garden. Okay? So the tree is in one person's garden, but the branches are now hanging over into the other person's garden. That other person, the dates are falling from the branches into his garden. His children come, small children, they don't know any better. They come, they see dates on the floor, dates have fallen. They go, they pick them up and they eat them. The guy whose tree it is, the owner of the tree, he doesn't like it. Even though it's falling into the other person's garden, he doesn't like it. He comes every once in a while, he shouts at the kids. He sees they've got dates in their hands, he hits their hands, the dates fall. They've got dates in their mouth, he tells them, spit it out. You don't have any right to have this, this is mine. Now this guy, the neighbor, he's fed up. He says, what do I do? I've got small kids, I can't look after them every single second of every day. They're going to pick up food, they're going to eat it, what's the big deal? So he's so disturbed by the neighbor, he goes to the Holy Prophet. He says, Ya Rasulullah, I have an issue, this is happening. Can you help me to solve this? Rasulullah, now put yourself into this position. What would you do? What would our leaders do? How would we solve this issue? Look at Rasulullah. He says, bring that man to me. The guy who owns the tree, bring him. The guy comes. Salawat ala Muhammad wa alihi.
Thank you. Allah.
Rasulullah says, bring that guy. Let me speak to him. The guy comes. He says, there's an issue between you and your neighbor. Okay, I'm going to try and solve it. He says, let's do one thing. Why don't you sell me your tree? I'll buy it from you. He says, no, I'm not going to sell it. Rasulullah says, okay, well, how about this? You sell me one tree, I'll give you a few trees in return. One, you give me, I'll give you a few. He says, no, this tree of mine is special. The dates are good, the branches are good, I'm not going to sell. Then Rasulullah gives him an offer that you can't refuse. But this guy refused. Rasulullah says, you sell me your tree, I guarantee you a tree in heaven. Give me your worldly tree, I'll give you a tree in heaven. Guess what he said? No. Who's seen heaven? I need something today. Now Rasulullah, he's getting disappointed. Luckily, one of the companions was listening. And he said, hang on a second, this is my opportunity. Look at how mu'min looks at this world and the life hereafter. Look at how mu'min juggles these things in his life. Look at how mu'min, a true mu'min, sees this world as nothing but a means to an end of the hereafter. He doesn't see it as a means in itself or an end in itself. The companion comes to Rasulullah and says, Ya Rasulullah, if I get that tree for you, will you give me a tree in heaven? Rasulullah says, definitely. He says, okay, let me work on it. He goes to that guy and he offers him, the hadith says, an orchard or a garden full of trees, which we estimate to be 10 to 15. He says, I'll give you prime land where I have trees. It's a whole garden, it's a whole orchard. You take all of them. You give me your one tree, which is causing you so much headache. He says, okay, fine. For a whole orchard, yeah, no problem. You take it. He goes to Rasulullah, he says, look, I've got it. It's mine, I'm giving it to you. Will you give me that tree in heaven? Rasulullah says, yes. When the Holy Prophet gives you a tree in heaven, it means that somehow guaranteed for you is heaven. Somehow, so a number of things we can take from this. Number one, look how petty some people are. Look how petty some people are. They can't stand to see fallen dates from a tree into the mouth of a young child. Number one, people are petty. Number two, look how Rasulullah deals with conflicts. He doesn't punish anyone. He doesn't shout. He doesn't badnam anyone. He doesn't spoil anyone's reputation. He doesn't do that. He deals with it very ethically, very nicely. Everyone's reputation is secured. Number three, he reminds people of Akhirat. This reminder of Akhirat is very important. You cannot live successfully in this world as a mu'min if you take your eye off the life hereafter. Then you'll become simply a materialistic, money-minded, consumption-minded person. There will be nothing else for you because you've taken your eye off the life hereafter. So Rasulullah secures the relationship, secures the izzat of these people, the honor. He makes sure their reputation is secure. And the companion is given a tree in heaven. Now let me give you another one from the life of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam. Allah. Imam similarly had a garden in Medina. Imam's approach was amazing. Allah, I don't know, will we ever have this tawfiq to be like our imams? Honestly, I wish we do. Imam used to harvest his dates, his garden of dates, for months and months and months. It's a big effort. When it came to the time of harvest, of taking the dates, you know what he used to do? His square-shaped or rectangle-shaped garden, he would actually tell his workers, I want you to make 10 holes in the wall and the doors, make 10 doors, holes in the wall. Make 10 holes and tell all the people, it's time for harvest, here are the dates, whatever you need, enter from any of these holes in the wall and take. No money, no purchasing, no restrictions, trust-based, come and take. Then, the person who's narrating this, he says, he didn't stop there. after the harvest was done and Imam took home his share, after everyone had taken as much as they wanted, Imam was left with a small share for his own household. After he took home his share, again he would say, now take some of this and go out and find the people who didn't come to the garden directly. Maybe they felt shy. Maybe they were embarrassed. Maybe the news didn't reach them. Make sure they get some as well. This is how we deal with the world. But there's a secret here. Someone who is too invested and too greedy for the world will not see it like this. So the underlying issue, the underlying disease in all of this is the love of this world. If we can deal with that, if we can put it in its proper place, that the world exists only as a platform and a springboard for the hereafter, then we will be much further ahead in our spiritual progress. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. One more narration. This is now from the life of the ulama. God bless our ulama. May he raise their station in the hereafter. May he always keep us under the supervision and guidance of our maraji. May he protect the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom, Najaf and these holy places, inshallah. Ayatollah Burujardi, wonderful personality. Let's have a salawat on his blessed name. If you have been to Qom, you would have seen his grave. His grave is unique. So when you come from the Zari in Qom, may Allah give us all tawfiq to go again and again for the death of Bibi Masuma, inshallah. Come from the Zari of Bibi Masuma, you come towards the place known as the graves of the ulama. Some graves are in the wall, meaning that their sign is in the wall. You have to be very careful there because it's easy to miss. Many people, not knowing the language, they miss that. In those walls, you'll see the grave, marking of the grave, it's not actually the grave, the marking of the grave of Shaykh Mutahari, Allama Tabatabai, and other such personalities. Very easy to miss. Then you have the main graves, which are actually structures raised from the ground. And then beyond that, on the other side of the wall, you'll find a unique grave, which is encased in glass. It has a picture of Ayatollah Burujardi on the wall, and it has his family tree on the other wall. Very interesting. If you look at his family tree, very highly reliable tracing back to the Ahlul Bayt. So that is where Ayatollah Burujardi is buried. Why is he given such a unique place? Because he did unique places, unique things for the place of Qom. Hawza Ilmiya Qom, it owes a lot to Ayatollah Burujardi. So in his earlier years, he sees a dream. The dream is that he walks into a room. In the room, there are lots of ulama. But one particular alim is seated next to Rasulullah himself. And Rasulullah is giving him a lot of respect. Rasulullah is giving him a lot of attention, a lot of respect. All the ulama are there, most of them are there. He can see them, but not this one in particular was given a unique place. So he's looking, he's thinking, why this person? And then he recognizes that it's actually his great-grandfather. Why is my great-grandfather being given such a distinction? Yes, he was a great alim, but these are all great alims. Rasulullah looks at him and says, you are wondering why I'm giving this, your great-grandfather, more attention than anyone else, aren't you? He said, yes, I am wondering. He said, let me tell you. Rasulullah explained. He said, all of these personalities here, they were all wonderful people. But there was one big difference. These others that you see, they were generous. Very generous. When they had, they gave. But this, your great-grandfather, when he didn't have, he looked, he got from other places, and then he gave. This is what gives him the distinction. To give when you have is a big thing, no doubt. to be generous with what you have is a big thing. But then to go out of your way and find ways of facilitating a better life for mu'mineen, this is also very important. So we have the approach from our first Imam, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salatu wa salam. Regarding, he finds it very strange, very surprising in the world when someone is a miser, because they are not using the resources that Allah has sent properly. A miser is someone, even if he's not generous with other people, he's also not generous with himself and his own family. One thing which I want to share with you, especially the men of the community. Islam has given the responsibility of financial upkeep of the family to who? Men. Husbands, fathers. What obligation of the finance of the household is on the woman? Zero. Nada. Zilch. Nothing. Men, we have a big responsibility. Some people look at Islam and they say, oh, women have a hard life in Islam. I'm telling you, if they knew the reality, they would say, we wish we were all women in Islam. The amount of freedom and the amount of lack of responsibility that a woman has, you will be shocked and amazed. Most of it is all recommended things, and yes, there's a massive amount of thawab. Upbringing, children, housework, making sure things are in good order, yes. It's a massive thawab and most of it is recommended. Otherwise, believe me, it would fall on us. I think I'm going to be very popular with one section of the crowd, but not very popular with another section of the crowd. But these are the realities, I'm sorry to say, that Islam has. So, we have a lot of responsibility and we need to understand. And we need to appreciate where we need to appreciate. Because there are some people in our households doing things over and above what Allah has commanded them to do. So we need to appreciate. Number two, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam al-Muttaqeen, Ali alayhi salatu wa salam. Allah. He says, the second thing which surprises me about people in this world, وَعَجِبْتُ لِلْمُتَكَبِّرِ, I'm very surprised at a person who lives in this world and can feel proud. Not mu'min, not Shia, not Muslim, any person. How can someone feel proud? Why? أَلَّذِي كَانَ بِالْأَمْسِ نُطْفَةً. Yesterday, this proud man in front of us was nothing but a drop of semen. He was a nutfa. He was nothing more. وَيَكُونُ غَدًا جِيفًا. And tomorrow he's going to be a rotting, stinking corpse. In between one drop of liquid and a rotting corpse, we feel this much pride. If, Amir al-Mu'mineen is saying, if we understand our origin and our destination, where we have come from, what actually we are in the grand scheme of things, and what we are actually going to become at the end of the day in a worldly sense, he says, how can this person feel pride? Hadith says, whoever has pride, Allah will lower him. Man takabbara wada'ahu Allah. Very interestingly, we're going to discuss this in the next few lectures regarding the hereafter and what will happen in the hereafter. Very interestingly, let me ask you a question. Let me see on the men's side who can give me a response. In the life hereafter, the proud man, the proud person or the proud woman will be raised as a tiny insect. Someone with a lot of pride will be raised as a tiny insect in the hereafter. Why? Who can give me an answer? Why? Why do you think? Why a proud person in the hereafter will be raised as a tiny insect?
Sorry?
If he used to think big of himself, why is he not a giant in the hereafter? You know, the thing is, the hereafter, it brings out our deepest, most reality. In the hereafter, nothing is hidden. Everything comes out. So a proud person in general, what happens is they actually feel very inferior inside. They've got a lot of insecurity. But they compensate insecurity with pride and haughtiness and commands and power and bullying. Whether they bully other people, whether they bully community members, whether they bully their families, whether they bully their wives or their children or their husbands or whatever. They manifest their weakness inside as pride because they don't want to deal with the real reality that I feel insecure. But in the hereafter, when everything comes out in a pure sense, when Allah extracts even the deepest thing inside our souls, you'll see that the proud person becomes a small insect because that insecurity of feeling small has come out as a reality, as a small insect. Very disturbing. We have to deal with this. Anyone, all of us, me included, you included, if we feel we have these specks of pride, we need to deal with it. Address it before it's too late. Humble yourselves. We all humble ourselves, inshallah. So, one of the ways we can humble ourselves, again according to Amirul Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salatu was salam. He says that in the worship of Islam, there are ways to deal with pride. The worships, the acts of worship in Islam, one of the secrets of these acts of worship is that increases humility and decreases pride. Well, you may say, we know many people, they worship a lot and still they're proud. So I would say they have not understood the worship properly. Someone who can lower his head so many times a day to the lowest point of the ground, where he would never lower his head normally, and he spreads himself on the floor like a beggar and bows in front of his Lord like a servant and stands with his hands humbly, with his heart shaking, that person will not feel pride. I'm sorry. If he prays like that, he will not feel pride. Someone who digs into his pocket and freely is able to give khums and think about others and give all manner of sadaqah as well on top of khums, but khums is wajib, sadaqah is mustahab in general. If he can do that, believe me, he will have less attachments to this world. But the person who gives and thinks, ah, this is really paining me. How many times have I seen, Allah bless our community, you know, honestly, people sometimes they think I'm not from this community because I criticize it so much, but I tell them, no, I criticize it because I'm from the community. And I've got a right to criticize because I'm from one of this own community. Sometimes you'll see people, you ask them for example for donation, yes, yes, how much do you need? You tell them how much, oh, Maulana, I'm not sure. Hand is not going on the checkbook very fluently. That reveals something. That tells us something, what's going on deeper. So, Amirul Mu'mineen says that your acts of worship will help you. He says, this pride is the thing against which Allah has protected His creatures. How? By means of prayer, namaz. Number two, almsgiving, sadaqat, khums. Suffering the hardship of fasting. Some people in the community, they say, why do we need to suffer so much in fasting? In some places, for example, you come to London, inshallah, you'll be fasting 18 to 20 hours a day in the summer. Why do we need such long hours of fasting? It's so difficult. Yes, because Allah wants us to feel a bit of difficulty. He wants us to feel a little bit of humility. The hardship of fasting in the days of fasting. Salawat. Why are all these things done? Amir al-Mu'mineen says, in order to give their limbs peace, to cast fear in their eyes, to make their spirits humble, to give their hearts humility, to remove pride from them. Ibadat, worship. But you have to approach it in the right way. You cannot just pray like a robot and say, oh, how come I'm not inspired by this prayer? How come people say, As-salah mi'rajul mu'min, namaz is a mi'raj of a mu'min. How come when I pray, I don't feel like that? Because we are approaching it in the wrong way. We look at it as a chore, as something that needs to be done, that it's an obstacle in the day, that I want to do so much, but this namaz has come in the way. If you approach it like that, of course you're not going to have a mi'raj. Of course you're not going to become humble. In fact, you'll probably resent it more, because you'll see it as an obstacle in your path. Allah is saying, this is not an obstacle. This is why I created you. It's not an obstacle. This is the reason you're here. Your work and your family and your other preoccupations, they are there to help you with your namaz. Not that your namaz gets in the way of these other things. All this, Amir al-Mu'mineen says, this is achieved through the covering of the delicate cheeks with dust. Where are the sajideen of our community? Where are those who spend hours in sajda? What about our fourth imam who could barely walk after his sujood? You know, regarding Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, they say we used to see him doing sajda for so long. Now when you're in a position for a long time, the blood stops and those limbs, you know what we say, pins and needles, you get pins and needles, you lose sense in those limbs. Sometimes it's hard to stand up, sometimes you know it takes time, you have to move your arm around for the blood to come back. Fourth Imam used to perform sajdas for so long that when he wanted to get up, he couldn't get up. He would have to almost like crawl a little bit to get the life back into his limbs. Where are the sajdas? Where are the cheeks upon the dust? Where are the foreheads covered in dust? They cover their delicate cheeks with dust, prostrate their limbs on the ground, retract their bodies to their backs by way of fasting. Look, he says, look at what there is in these acts by reducing pride and suppressing vanity. This is what I want to leave you with today. We didn't get to the other items. Maybe inshallah in a future lecture we can look at them. There are four more we didn't even get to, but at least two we have covered today. How Amir al-Mu'mineen is shocked and surprised by the way we live. Believe me, this is as relevant today as it was then when he said it. The kalam of the ma'sumeen is everlasting. Kalam of Allah is everlasting. Please don't ever think these were things for a past that is no longer there. No, these were things for human nature. Human nature is not going to change until the day of judgment. So these things are there. May Allah give us tawfiq, forgive us our sins, bless our marhumeen, accept our azar, accept our mourning, accept our ibadat, give us the benefit of these ibadat in our lives, as our first imam has said, inshallah. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah al-Husayn. We have so many teachings regarding azar of Imam Hussein. I don't know where to begin. Let me begin with one of the most famous. Eighth Imam calls his companion Rayyan ibn Shabib. It's a long hadith. I will just narrate a few lines. He says, Ya ibn Shabib, let me give you some advice. In kunta baqiyan li shay'in fabki lil Hussein ibn Ali. He said, Ya ibn Shabib, if ever you want to cry over anything, do not cry over any worldly thing, do not waste your time. If you feel emotional and you feel like crying, remember Hussein ibn Ali. Why? Because he was killed like the animals are slaughtered. Ya ibn Shabib, in bakita ala al-Husayn. Oh son of Shabib, let me tell you something. If you are able to cry over Hussein to the extent where even one tear flows from your